I was at for my birthday a couple of weeks ago, my family gave me tickets to a Creative Life conference that Michael Card, a longtime Christian music artist, was putting on, and he was teaching these sessions about creativity and the interaction between God as a creative God and his people as being creative people. And a special guest at the conference was Phil Keaggy, who is a longtime guitar player. Back in the, I think, 60s or 70s, when he had just won a Battle of the Bands thing with his high school band, was awarded a concert at Carnegie Hall. The producer for Jimi Hendrix heard the concert and was amazed, and said he wanted to record for Phil. And sometime right after that, Jimi Hendrix was asked, you know, what's it like to be the greatest guitar player in the world? And Hendrix said, I don't know, ask Phil Keaggy. Now, 30 years later, 40 years later, Keaggy's still playing, and he's an amazing, it's amazing to watch the creativity that's just, he just gets these ideas, and he'll try something, and you know how fast his fingers can move across the fretboard is just, it's amazing. So we got treated to some of his creative guitar playing at this conference, and afterwards Michael Card came up and said, when God made Phil Keaggy, he was just showing off. God is amazingly creative. But sometimes he does things that just show off how great his power and greatness is. And I think we're going to be looking at one of those occasions today where Jesus did something that was really just to show off how great his power was to his group of disciples. It seems kind of odd to think of God or Jesus showing off, but you know, if you think about our own human tendency, we all like to show off and get people to admire us, don't we? I think that is part of having the image of God in us. God is that way too. He likes to show off and have people worship him. He deserves it. He can do that without sinning in the process. We have the problem that we like people to admire us because we like to stand in the place of God and get the worship that God deserves. Sin makes that a real problem for us when we show off. But for Jesus, there was no sin in him. And it was perfectly right for him to show off, perfectly right for him to be worshipped. So let's get into this passage here. Chapter 14, starting at verse 22. I did not have the time to put text up onto my PowerPoint, so I do have a few photos. This photo is of the Sea of Galilee at night. It could be morning, but we'll pretend this is night because this is the time that we're talking about right now. Jesus immediately made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side until whenever he had dismissed the crowds. Jesus forced or constrained his disciples to leave early and go home ahead of him. Remember the what has just happened there in this deserted area is Jesus has just fed these 5,000 men and who knows how many women and children as well. Then as soon as the dinner hour is over, just as evening sets on, he tells his disciples, the word is strong, he forced or constrained his disciples to leave early and go home ahead of him. Why is this? The parallel account in John, we have the same story in Mark and Matthew and John. Parallel account in John tells us, therefore, when the people saw the sign of the feeding of the 5,000, which he had performed, They said, "This is truly the prophet who has come into the world." So Jesus, perceiving that they were intending to come and take him by force to make him king, withdrew. So this is the context. The people think he's the prophet. That's referring to Deuteronomy 18:15, where Moses prophesies, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. Listen to him." They say, this is it. He's the new king. And so the urgency with which Jesus sends his disciples away in the boat and sends the crowds away was to prevent them from implementing a bad idea of proclaiming him to be king that day instead of Herod. We looked at what Herod was like a couple weeks ago. You can see what kind of sparks would have flown. Perhaps Jesus convinced his disciples that saying, "Well, somebody's got to take the boat back home. I want to be alone. I need some time alone. John's just died. I want some time to process that. You guys are tired. You've had a long ministry trip. And I took you out on this adventure just as the moment you came home from your ministry trip. Now it's time for you to go home, go to bed. You're tired." Perhaps Jesus had to tell Peter, "Look, just do what I say. Go. You'll understand later." The other side of the lake, see if that map comes up. Yeah. Well, oh dear. You can see it that way, maybe. Here's a little map of the Sea of Galilee. They're currently somewhere around here, probably. Possibly over here. And the other side of the lake then would be the north end of the lake, where Capernaum and Bethsaida and the plain of Gennesaret are. And that's where they end up. It would have been 3 or 4 miles of sailing as the crow flies then from the one, from the east side to the north side. But apparently there was a wind from the north or the northeast that blew them off course towards the center of the lake and doubled their driving time, whatever, sailing time, as it were, distance. Jesus also, so the lake is about 7 miles wide at the widest point. Jesus is also having to stop the crowd. Once he gets rid of the disciples, he also has to get rid of the crowds, interrupting them from carrying out this plan to proclaim him the next king. So he goes back and tells them it's time to go home now. Verse 23, after dismissing the crowds, he went up the hill by himself to pray. And after it was late, he was alone there. 17th century Bible commentator Matthew Henry noted that this word "send away," apolousos, and intimates somewhat of solemnity in the dismissing of them. He sent them away with a blessing, with some parting words of caution or counsel or comfort, which might abide with them. And then Jesus ascends. You see, the lake is kind of down in a low altitude, and there's hills going up all around it. So Jesus goes up the hill from the lake at that point to spend the night praying in the hills. Apparently, the Jews had built a lot of little private prayer sanctuaries up in those hills. And so some people think that he probably, there was some kind of a little hut or something that he had in mind that he was going to spend the night praying in. What do you suppose Jesus prayed about? Doing an all-nighter in prayer. He's just sent his disciples away, just sent the crowds back after feeding them. We don't have his prayer recorded here, but we do have other prayers that he prayed recorded. And it's clear that when Jesus prayed, he didn't only pray for himself. There were things he prayed about concerning himself, but then he would start praying for his disciples, and then he would start praying for the people that his disciples would then influence. John 17 is kind of the most classic example of Jesus' prayer, the way Jesus prayed. And so I expect that Jesus was praying for his disciples as they head out across the lake into the storm. 20th century Bible commentator William Hendrickson wrote the following: "Oh, that an artist would reproduce this combined scene. The disciples, apparently in peril of losing their lives on this stormy sea, but Jesus on the hill interceding for them, undoubtedly including also this petition that they might be safeguarded against misleading messianic conceptions, and that their lives might be spared so that they'd be able to carry out their tasks." Seen from that angle, were not his disciples safe after all? Doesn't this combined picture have many applications for the present day and for every time of trouble and distress? Verse 24 says, "Now by this time the boat was in the middle of the lake, being beat up by the waves, for the wind was contrary." Now, if you're reading from an English Bible that was translated in the 20th century, it probably says something about the boat being a certain distance away from land. If you're reading a King James Bible, it'll say the boat was in the midst of the sea. I personally think the King James reading is better here, that the textual, that the Greek manuscripts supporting what it says are better and more substantial in this case, not always. But I don't actually have a quarrel with the wording that that's in the modern English Bibles, because it's supported by the parallel account in the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of John, it uses the same unit of distance, the stadia, which is translated distance, I think, in the English Bibles. John says that the boat had gotten out 25 to 30 stadia from land, which could be translated a long way or a considerable distance. It's about 3.5 miles. Since the Sea of Galilee is about 7 miles wide, 3.5 miles puts them in the middle of the lake. So both ways that it's worded, whether you're reading King James or a modern English version, they're saying the same thing. They're in the middle of the lake. They're out about 3.5 miles from shore. The wind has blown them off course, apparently, in order to put them in the middle of the lake. I just put in a plug here, just from my study of comparing the Greek manuscripts that form the basis of our English Bibles, it is amazing how God has preserved them. Even though we have these two different wordings, they're saying the same thing. And I believe that's God's sovereignty in preserving his word. So the wind's blowing them in the opposite way. They're having to row against the wind then. They're rowing. So back, it's going to be to the contrary winds, trying to make progress towards the north side of the lake. It's blowing hard. It's whipping up waves that are beating and buffeting and battering the boat and tossing it around. These guys are in trouble. What happened? Did somebody do something wrong? What was going on here? I believe the entire thing was a divine setup. It was planned by Jesus to purposefully put his disciples in a stressful position, rowing all night long in a storm. That'd be stressful. And then show off the power of Jesus in an extravagant way, walking on water, for crying out loud. And it was all done for a very specific purpose, to strengthen the faith of these disciples. That was the whole point of this exercise that Jesus had divinely planned out. I mean, this is boot camp for his followers, to strengthen their faith. He knew that after ascending into heaven, after he had died for their sins, he needed to leave behind a group of men who were completely dedicated to him, who trusted him implicitly, convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was God and was their only way of salvation. In order to leave behind a group of people like that, he had to put them through experiences that would strengthen, test, confirm their faith. I believe this was a purposefully orchestrated exercise. Of course, the disciples didn't know this. They probably had a lot of misgivings as that storm whipped up. Maybe they were thinking about Jonah. The storm came and, you know, Jonah had to get thrown to the bottom of the sea. But wait a minute, didn't Jesus, but Jonah was doing the opposite of what God had told him to do. We're doing what Jesus told us to do and we're running into this problem. What's wrong here? What a terrible mistake. We're all going to die out here in the middle of the lake and nobody's ever going to know. Except for Jesus who sent us out here. I think we can learn from this that if you become a follower of Christ, your troubles are not going to go away. You're going to enter training sessions. God is going to work on building your faith by introducing stress into your life that forces you to trust Him. Matthew Henry wrote, "It's no new thing for Christ's disciples to meet with storms in the way of their duty. Christ designs hereby to manifest himself with the more wonderful grace to them and for them. Christ accustomed his disciples first to lesser difficulties and then to greater." The last time they're in a storm at sea, Jesus was with them. This time, he's not even in sight. It's going to be a little progressive challenge for their faith. Matthew Henry continues, "He trains them up by degrees to live by faith and not by sense. Note, though troubles and difficulties may disturb us in our duty, they must not drive us from it. But through the midst of them, we must press forwards." Again, the example of the disciples, they didn't tack about and pull back to the shore they left from. They kept following the orders of their master, even though it meant spending all night rowing against a contrary wind. They made their best way forward. Now, I think even this was divinely inspired. Which direction were the disciples looking? If you're rowing north, they're looking back towards the shore they left. This was important because Jesus wanted to see him walking out on the water to them. They're going to get a full view of Jesus' stunt here.
I think I made a slide of that. Go back to it. If I will pull us back to the first slide. There we go.
"During the last quarter of the night, Jesus went out to them," verse 25, "walking upon the lake." That last watch, the Roman soldiers divided nights into 4 3-hour watches for their night security guards. So the fourth watch would be between 3 and 6 a.m. So that means the disciples, you know, this is somewhere, you know, 4 or 5 a.m., the disciples have been rowing all night. There's an old saying, "He may not come when you want him, but he's right on time." Verse 26, "Once the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they became agitated, saying that it was an apparition. And because of their fear, they cried out." I think it's interesting that the last time there was this storm on the lake and people cried out, when Jesus approached them, it was the evil spirits that were crying out. Matthew 8:29, when Jesus touched down on and Gadara and went up to these two demon-possessed men, the two demon-possessed men started screaming as Jesus approached them out of fear because the demons inside them were terrified of Jesus. Here, Jesus' followers themselves are screaming out of terror as Jesus comes near. They think it's an evil spirit approaching them that's made itself visible to their physical eyes. And Jesus immediately spoke to them, saying, "Keep being courageous. I myself am here. Stop being afraid." It's interesting that when Jesus corrects a problem, he speaks into it. He is the Word of God, and so he speaks to address problems. and that his word changes things. And that is, you know, that is his modus operandi. That's why the Bible is so important. It is his word which is spoken into our life. That's how he addresses issues. He begins by speaking to his disciples in the boat, that same word that he gave to the paralyzed man lower down through the roof. Same word he gave to the woman with the issue of blood. Be courageous. Take heart. Take courage. Be of good cheer. Tharsite. You guys have made a good show of courage by rowing for 8 hours in the middle of the night like that. Keep your courage up. Don't allow fear to creep in and paralyze you. Kick those fears out. Trust that I'll keep you safe. And then he says, It is I. I think it's reasonable to translate it that way. The Greek phrase, ego, a me, I myself am, is literally what that phrase is. And it's the very name that God gave to Moses and Israel back in Exodus 3:13 when Moses said, look, I'm going to be going in front of the elders of Israel to carry a message. Whom shall I say sent me? And God replies, let me get the exact words. Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am, ego eimi, has sent you. It was on the basis of who Jesus was that the disciples could be courageous and not fearful. The only reasonable reason not to be afraid would be the fact that Jesus has limitless power and infinite, intensely personal love for them. If he were not all-powerful, if he did not love them, then they would have great reason to be afraid. But since he is all-powerful and does love us, there is no reason to become paralyzed with fear. We can affirm with the writer of Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5, he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? The Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. Verse 28, Peter responds. In answer, Peter said, Lord, if you yourself are here, command me to come to you upon the waters. The grammatical form of Peter's if-then statement in the Greek, the A plus an indicative, indicates that Peter believed this was true. Peter believed Jesus was indeed standing there and that Jesus is the God of Moses who is named I Am. Now, some Bible scholars, John Calvin was one of them, believe that Peter was rash and unbelieving for wanting to do this. And I think we have to agree there was a certain recklessness in his request. But then again, when did Peter ever do anything halfway? Lord, you're never going to wash my feet. What? Okay, well then wash my whole body. I mean, you know, he never did anything halfway. Other Bible scholars believe that Peter was doing the right thing. Matthew Henry wrote, Christ is well pleased with the expressions of his people's love, though mixed with manifold infirmities, and makes the best of them. I side with the latter. I think Jesus was pleased with this as an expression of faith and an expression of a desire to be with him. I think Jesus was pleased with that. Even if it, you know, even if there was some recklessness, some poorly thought through thinking, and I believe Jesus is the same way with us, that we don't always respond in the wisest, you know, smartest way, but God appreciates, because he is a personal God, he appreciates our faith and our love, even when it is imperfectly expressed. Does that make sense? He will accept your faith and your love, even if you're not doing it perfectly. Have you ever seen a movie with a love story where the guy and the girl are running across a field of flowers and jumping into each other's arms at the end? What if it was just the guy running across the field and the girl sitting here like this? Was waiting for him to arrive. How would that change the picture? When you think about this situation, it seems only natural. Jesus is coming this way, and Peter's going to come the other way. He's not going to sit and wait for Jesus to reach him. Christ comes to us. We go out with him. Those words, the coming of Christ and coming are constantly throughout the Bible. And God's followers going is constantly throughout the Bible. Both of those things are themes throughout Scripture. Christ comes, we go. Notice Peter does not frame his request as just wanting to walk on water, to do this glamorous deed. What he asked for is to be commanded to come to Jesus. That's what he's asking for. I think that indicates his heart's in the right place. He loves Jesus so much, he's not content to stand in the boat and wait for Jesus to arrive. He wants to rush out and be with Jesus as quickly as possible. Remember, he did that again later on, after Jesus' resurrection. Who's that out on the shore? Oh, it's Jesus. And he dives over the side and swims. He's not going to wait for the ship to come to shore. Notice also that Peter moderates his eagerness with a humble acknowledgement that Jesus is his Lord and Master. You're the Master. When you say jump, I'll jump. So, Jesus, I'm just posting notice here. If you'll just say the word, I'm going to be over the gunwale and going to you. Storm or no storm. I think this submission to the will of Christ, submission to the will of Christ is just as important as loving him. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments, Jesus also said. I'll quote Matthew Henry again. Our will to accomplish services and sufferings is interpreted not as willingness, but as willfulness if it have not a regard to the will of Christ and be not regulated by his call and counsel. We don't honor Christ by cooking up our own ideas and doing our own will. We honor him and love him by doing what he has commanded. And in verse 29, Jesus responds positively. He says, come. So after disembarking from the boat, Peter walked upon the waters in order to come to Jesus. Wow. It's quite a miracle for Jesus to do this walking on the water thing, a midnight stroll across the surface of a stormy lake, but double well for him to make it a stroll for two. Then verse 30, as he saw the strong wind, Peter became frightened. Then he began to drown and cried out, saying, Lord, save me. The power that Jesus was exercising to put them on the lake, on the surface of the lake, was not the only power at work. Peter started thinking about the other power, this strong, boisterous wind that's blowing the foam off the top of the white caps into his face. His attention becomes divided. He's thinking about this other power that stands contrary to Jesus's power. Inevitably, those of us who take a step of faith will have occasion to have second thoughts. Whoa, what was I thinking? Adopting another kid? What was I thinking? Every one of us I'm sure every one of us. What was I thinking being a church pastor? We have our times of second thoughts. Feeling like, I can't do this. I've started into something that I can't be done. I must have heard wrong from God. I must have done the wrong thing. There's panic sets in. This is nuts. It's not going to work. I jumped the gun. It's, you know, natural and understandable that Peter would feel this way. But what is it that makes us feel that way? It is forgetting who Jesus is. Isaiah 51:3 says that clearly. You forgot Jehovah your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and founded the earth, and so you are in continual dread all the day. You forgot him, and so you were frightened. Looking at difficulties with an eye of sense more than at precepts and promises with the eye of faith is at the bottom of all our inordinate fears. We all feel that way from time to time. And then all that's left for us to do is exactly what Peter did. And that is to say, Lord, save me. And when we ask him to, God's right hand will uphold us. Psalm 46, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in times of trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, because he's right there, a present help in times of trouble. When we hit the wall, we need to pray, Lord, save me. And he is there. He is a very present help in these times of trouble. Immediately, verse 31, Jesus extended his hand, grabbed him, and said to him, little faith, why did you think twice? Deja vu. Remember the last time Jesus rescued his disciples from a storm on that same lake? Matthew 8:25, his disciples approached, woke him up, saying, Lord, save us, we're perishing. And he says to them, little faith, Oligopiste, why are you intimidated? This has already happened once. Jesus is driving the lesson home again. This time, Jesus adds an interesting word, distasas. Why did you doubt? Literally, why did you think twice? What did you think you could get out of dividing your attention between me and the waves? What purpose would having second thoughts have? Peter, man, you have the courage and the faith to move mountains and go to the ends of the earth. Don't let doubts creep in and stop you. He who hesitates is lost. Again, that's a good word for us. When we hit the wall, and issues of faith, we need to be careful that we're not double-minded. Verse 32, after they got up into the boat, the wind quit. It ceased, stopped, died down. It's like the faith training exercise is over. Simulator shuts off. No more wind. Stress levels return to normal. And that's when it hits them. Wait a minute. This whole experience was totally under Jesus' control. The wind, the course of our journey, the timing, the appearance of Jesus, it was all a carefully orchestrated situation for us to see just how awesome Jesus is. No normal human being can do this kind of stuff. This is God. In the scriptures previous to Matthew, God's already been portrayed as being able to break the physical properties of water. Exodus 15:8, God is said to congeal the deeps in the heart of the sea. Okay, he made, and Exodus 15, God made water solid at room temperature. Conversely, he could do the opposite. Psalm 114:8, he turns a rock into a pool of water. He can take a solid, turn it into water. At his word. He even made an axe head float. Remember back during Elisha's ministry, 2 Kings 6, iron floating in water. Job 9:8 says, God alone tramples down the waves of the sea. And in Psalm 77, it says, your way was in the sea and your paths in the mighty waters, and your footprints may not be known. You think Jesus left footprints when he walked across the lake? God is portrayed as the one who comes across, who walks on the water. This is already an Old Testament concept. God is portrayed as the one who can reverse the physical properties of water. And when the disciples see that, they say, yes, this is God. And they worship him. This is a step up from the last time Jesus calmed the storm. Remember what they said then? What kind of a man is this? Now they're saying, this is the Son of God. This is a man with the qualities of God. The men in the boat came and bowed down to him, verse 33, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. Remember, Jews didn't bow before humans. The word translated worshipped is the same word for bow down before. They're, you know, synonymous acts. They bowed down in front of him and worshipped him as God. This was a significant action. The phrase Son of God would also be an acknowledgement that Jesus is the Messiah. So, sorry that image is a little fuzzy, but that's morning on the Sea of Galilee. Let me conclude with four, or let's see, is it five summary points? Just reminding us of the character of Christ. First, Jesus is powerful. This story teaches us that Jesus is powerful. We need to remember that. Never forget it. He controlled the crowds, verse 22. He controlled the wind, verse 33. He controlled the water, verse 25. Used the storm as his pathway. He had the power to save Peter and the rest of the disciples from drowning. He even seems to demonstrate some supernatural power in their destination. They're in the middle of the lake when they see Jesus approach. And then Jesus climbs into the boat. And John 6:21 says that they were suddenly on the shore and no longer in the middle of the lake when Jesus climbed into the boat. Where did those 3.5 miles go? Jesus exercised supernatural power. He can do anything. If Jesus had that power back then, he still has that power today. Power over every problem we face and power to control any situation for us. The question is, do you believe that? Secondly, Jesus is involved. Just as Jesus didn't use his power to prevent the storm and make his disciples' life easy, but used a stressful situation to train his disciples, increasing their faith, you too can expect Jesus will be involved in your life by bringing stressful situations. maybe not the most pleasant thought. But again, remembering that Jesus is powerful, that he's in control of this and has your best interest in mind, can put us at ease as we go through whatever stresses he brings about in our life. If we trust him in that stress, he will meet us in it, just as he did with the disciples. He will bring us through it, just as he did with the disciples. He will not be aloof to your hardship. Just as Jesus was praying for his disciples, they couldn't see him, but he was praying for them as they braved that storm. So Jesus, even now, stands before the throne of God, interceding for us. That's what Hebrews 7:25 says, that he lives to intercede for you. That's what he does. That's his job now. For this reason, we can take courage and not be afraid. Thirdly, Jesus is our example. He's all powerful. He's involved in our life. He's our example in life. And mainly just see this by his example in prayer, as well as his example in training disciples. But in prayer, you know, he's already said back in chapter 6, as for you, whenever you pray, go into your closet, shut the door, start praying to your Father who's in the secret place. And Jesus is practicing what he preached. He's going off by himself, shutting the door in his little prayer sanctuary, and spending time alone with God praying. Now, of course, prayer alone with God is not the only way to pray. It's also proper to pray in groups with other people. But there are many, many blessings and benefits to praying alone with God. John Calvin wrote these, those who set themselves to pray with God as their only witness will be more watchful, will pour forth their heart into his bosom, will examine themselves more carefully, and knowing that they have to do with God, will rise above themselves. So Jesus is our example as a man of prayer. Fourth, Jesus is about the work of nurturing faith. Remember that it's God's purpose for you to grow in faith in him. I think his pet name for Peter there, Little Faith, was designed to push Peter to grow, to have more faith. Jesus' question of Peter is a good one to help us consider how to grow in our faith. Why did you doubt? If I could give you homework, I would say there's your homework for this week. It's take some time to think. Why did you doubt the last time you were struggling? What were the issues? If you can identify what they are and fight them by faith, you're going to see greater victory the next time this happens. Think it through. Was it because you had a hardened heart? Was it because you were thinking about the contrary forces arrayed against you rather than Christ? Whatever the case, Jesus is going to get what he wants. If you're his child, he is going to drive you to trust him more and more. He's going to get that result. And he gets it from his disciples. At the end of the story, they bowed down and worshiped him as God. Finally, Jesus is gracious. We need to remember that Jesus is gracious. When we find ourselves in trouble due to our own foolishness, Jesus doesn't say, "I told you so," and just, "You deserve it. Just drown. Go ahead." That's not the way Jesus is. He responds with salvation to those who ask for it, even when they don't deserve it. Jesus, the way that Jesus saved Peter is teaches us about what he's like. Jesus could have just said up, and Peter would have just shot up out of the water like a rocket, landed back in his seat, totally dry as though he'd never been in the water. But that would have communicated a different thing about God, wouldn't it? It would have communicated impersonality. When Jesus reached, touched, drew him to himself, that communicates a different kind of God, a God who draws us, who reaches out to us, touches us when we mess up, draws us to himself, not a God that pushes us away or that just cleans up your mess and wishes you were more mature. He's a God who draws us into himself, touches us, will draw closer when we mess up and cry out to him. That is the kind of God we worship. He's gracious. Jesus didn't say, "Weakling, can't run with the big dogs, then just don't even try." That's not how he treated Peter. He doesn't make fun of us, doesn't leave us to suffer when we fail. It is his nature to save us and train us to trust him in a more focused way. These are all things I believe that we need to remember about Jesus, because it's going to be so easy to forget every one of these. Jesus is powerful. Jesus is involved in your life. Jesus teaches you by example to pray. Jesus is nurturing faith in you. And Jesus will be gracious to you when you call upon him.